evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, April 21st, 2022. Some Sudanese activists say the country's judiciary is not up to the task.
This is a miserable trial. Any attempt to free al-Bashir and others in such a way will be faced with rejection from the public.
And some oil workers in South Sudan go on strike.
They refuse to sign the payroll, so that is illegal strategy and the new policy.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some residents of the Sudanese capital Khartoum and civil society activists say the judicial system in Sudan is not fair. After a video circulating on social media show former detained Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir visiting patients in a hospital in Khartoum, the video sparked widespread controversy. Some civil society activists accused the judiciary of not being serious. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Some Sudanese activists posted on social media videos of al-Bashir appearing to be in good health while visiting patients in Sudanese Army's Aliyah Hospital. Late last week, the former president's defense lawyer submitted a petition to the court to release all criminal suspects who are 70 years and above. They also want the court to grant a special bail for all those whose charges are not punishable by the death penalty upon conviction. Al-Bashir's defense lawyer says his client has been hospitalized for over a month but declined to provide details. Samia Argawi, a member of a Sudanese civil society organization, Not Women Oppression, says Bashir appeared healthy while visiting patients, which he says contradicts the reports of the lawyer. Argawi says the video shown on social media confirms that al-Bashir is fit and in good health. We have seen him smiling and visiting other patients, in other words, without any difficulties. She says this is contrary to what has been said earlier, that he is ill and his health condition cannot allow him to be in Kobar prison, Argawi says. Asa Tatahir, a member of a Sudanese NGO, Community Empowerment for Development, says whatever the circumstances are, al-Bashir should be held in prison and be charged with crimes he committed in Darfur and other locations in Sudan during the 3 decades he was in power. He says Sudanese revolutionaries will continue to call for transitional justice.
This is a miserable trial. Any attempt to free al-Bashir and others in such a way will be faced with rejection from the public. This is a violation of the justice system and of our revolution.
Khartoum resident Khalid Taha calls the video circulating on social media an emotional setback to victims of mass crimes committed by al-Bashir and his supporters. Taha says the court should never accept any medical reports from the hospital after seeing the video that went viral.
This is propaganda for all the cases of transitional justice in the country. The court is the only way that our people would achieve transitional justice against all the members of the National Congress Party.
Khartoum resident Hiba Ali says there has been much speculation about Bashir's case, including reports that his file has been misplaced. Ali says the military leaders who took control of the country after the October 2021 coup are trying to free al-Bashir and his former top officials from prison. Ali says the big challenge at the moment is military coup that is heavily interfering with the court proceedings. She says, "We have been following all what has been happening. I don't think there is going to be a serious and fair trials on these individuals." Khartoum residents and civil society activists say they fear the judiciary might drop all charges leveled against Bashir. Bashir and a number of his former top officials have been indicted by the International Criminal Court in The Hague on war crimes and crimes against humanity. Last week, the Khartoum court ordered the immediate release of 20 members of Bashir's supporters, including former Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour, who has been held in jail since June 2020. The presiding judge said the court could not find any concrete evidence to charge the freed individuals. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Workers with the Dar Petroleum Operating Company in South Sudan's Upper Nile State are on strike. The workers have accused their employer of failing to implement the South Sudan labor policies. A representative of the workers say operations at various oil fields have stopped. Dengai Deng reports for VOA from Bor.
Striking oil workers at the Paloch, Gumiri and other oil fields in Upper Nile State say Dar Petroleum Operating Company, or DPOC, has ignored the Unified Human Resource Policy Manual, which was approved by the South Sudan government last year. A representative of the oil workers, Daniel Malik, says more than 1,000 DPOC employees are demanding the company implement provisions spelled out in the manual, which require the contractor to pay employees certain allowances on top of their salaries.
They refuse to sign the payroll, so that is our legal salary based on the new policy. So this has been the issue from 2021. Up to now, the companies are just operating without any policies, and they are resisting the government directive. So this has forced the staff now to go on a strike.
Malik says South Sudanese workers are fed up with what he calls the company's pay discrimination against locals. He says nationals are paid less than foreign employees who do the same job.
The only demand that we have is for default management, and all the JOCs, all the joint operating companies that are conducting oil business in South Sudan to operate based on law. That's the only demand. We only want them to immediately start operating using the new AR policy, this new Unified Human Resource Policy. If they implement it tomorrow, I believe all the staff will go back to work and they will not run a strike.
Ayuel Akoch, the vice president of Dar Petroleum Operating Company, declined to comment on the strike. Petroleum Minister Port Kang Chol says he ordered all oil companies operating in South Sudan, including DPOC, to implement the new labor policy and local content in the Unified Human Resource Policy Manual last year.
We gave directives to the oil companies to implement the manual. Manual was passed by the Council of Ministers, so it became part and parcel of the laws given in the oil sector. We are having back and forth meetings with the partners, the CNPC, Petronas, OCC, TriOcean, and Sinopec. We have been doing that. But they have been having their own demands, which we said if they are within the legal framework, we have no problem. We will be able to implement that. But anything outside the legal framework, we will not be able to implement it. So we are pushing for the implementation.
Chol is urging DPOC workers to call off their strike and insist his ministry is fighting for the oil field workers' rights and hopes to resolve the dispute over allowances soon.
We would not want the production to be affected. We are telling the nationalists, yes, they are right, they are demanding their rights, but we are telling them to go back to work because the government is intact and we are all pursuing the cause and we will continue to do it.
The human resource policy mandates the harmonization of salary structure applicable to national and international staff and says salaries of workers in the joint operating companies shall be reviewed and communicated to them. A little over a year, national employees of Dar Petroleum Operating Company went on a strike over the implementation of the policy. In his Independence Day message last year, President Salva Kiir called on the Petroleum Ministry to effect the changes required in the manual. Since 2019, South Sudanese nationals working on oil fields have been demanding payment in dollars, health insurance, promotions, and capacity building opportunities, just as their colleagues from foreign countries receive from oil companies. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Bor.
The South Sudan Refugee Commission has rejected a request to contribute towards the support of South Sudanese refugees' welfare in Uganda. An official with the South Sudan Refugee Commission says the host country, along with international organizations, are responsible for providing support to refugees in Uganda. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
Last week, Uganda's State Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees, Esther Anyakun Davina, asked South Sudan to mobilize resources and send to Uganda as part of humanitarian support for the two countries' refugees that Uganda is hosting. She noted that Uganda is bearing the burden of hosting tens of thousands of refugees from South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo, yet neither country contributes funds for the refugees. A Ugandan newspaper, The Daily Monitor, quoted Uganda's State Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees as saying South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo must send Uganda money since the state has been paying for their refugees' food and welfare. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus today, John Darby, the Deputy Commissioner for the South Sudan Refugees Commission, says South Sudan will not be sending Uganda money for refugees.
Normally, when the refugees cross to another country, they become refugees, they are registered. Normally, it is the responsibility of the host country, which takes care of them and provide funding. And also with the international community, the UNHCR and World Food and the rest.
Last month, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and other humanitarian agencies in East Africa appealed for $1.2 billion to respond to the humanitarian needs of the South Sudanese refugees living in neighboring countries. Darby says South Sudan and its international partners are struggling to provide protection and humanitarian assistance to hundreds of thousands of refugees seeking safety inside South Sudan.
Over 360,000 whom we are taking care of jointly with UNHCR. They are from different countries, but 90% from Sudan, from the Blue Nile region and then the South Kordofan region. Then we have from Congo, DRC, and then we have from some from Ethiopia, and then some from Central African Republic. So it's like a number of countries. It's not just one country.
Uganda, the DRC, and South Sudan have all hosted refugees for decades. Darby says if there are serious concerns about the humanitarian situation of South Sudanese refugees, Uganda should address those concerns through diplomatic means.
So if there is anything, they could communicate to us through the Foreign Office, through our embassy in Uganda. It will be much, much easier for us to understand and to handle. But like this one now, it's just a unfounded statement, and we are not able to work on this kind of statements.
Uganda is a home to nearly 1 million South Sudanese who fled their country following the outbreak of war in 2013 and 2016. In September 2018, South Sudan's warring parties signed a rift-less peace agreement requiring the transitional government to immediately institute programs for the repatriation of refugees. Darby says those preparations have yet to be completed. Last month, the Norwegian Refugee Council said in a study that a reduction in food aid at refugee camps in Uganda has forced many South Sudanese refugees to make dangerous and expensive journeys back to their home country, which often involves the risk of violence and extortion. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
Some residents of the South Sudan capital, Juba, say food prices have increased over the past few days. Traders say high import tax is to blame for the skyrocketing prices. Sheila Pony reports for VOA from Juba.
Residents say a 10-kilogram bag of flour that used to cost 2,500 South Sudanese pounds a few days ago has jumped to 4,000 South Sudanese pounds. Traders say they are forced to pay a high import tax at the Nimule border crossing point and must cover those costs to earn a profit. Juba town resident Sarah Gandhi says she spends more than she earns to put food on the table. Gandhi has stepped into a community of young women who can no longer afford to put food on the table.
I used to buy tomatoes at 500 SSP, but if you go into a market today, a kilo will go for 1,000, and that clearly tells us that the price has doubled. Onions that used to be at 500 SSP a kilogram is now at 700 to 800 SSP. Now tell me, if you are to have a decent meal as a family, would you afford that? Of course not.
Juba resident Jagai James says it's nearly impossible to feed her five children and pay other expenses with the higher prices.
The salary is not even enough to solve the problem of a child. Children will not be educated and the number of street children is going to increase. We, the mother, have nothing to do. We run up and down trying to work, but the money is not enough. We want the government to intervene because the prices of basic commodities increase daily. We have now resorted to one meal a day.
Justin Vera Michael, a father of five in Juba's Gudele neighborhood, says although there is relative peace now, people are still suffering due to soaring prices and unpaid salaries.
We thought things would be better and we would be free if peace comes, but things are very expensive in the market.
Nankumba Aisha, a Ugandan trader at Freedom Market, says the jump in food prices was triggered by higher transportation costs and commodity prices in Uganda.
Most of the goods we are bringing them from Uganda, most of them from Uganda. So prices in Uganda have increased. Thus, you cannot sell something. You have to first budget it and know, I bought it this price, I'm selling it this price. The taxes in Uganda, people are complaining of. The taxes are high. Petrol is high. That's what we are hearing. That's why things are very expensive now, like soap and sugar.
Aisha says the depreciation of the local currency also discourages traders from importing food, causing the supply chain network to stale. For VOA News, I am Sheila Aponi in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, how is the war in Ukraine affecting global economy? Find out more after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. The International Monetary Fund on Tuesday slashed its forecast for global economic growth to 3.6% this year, saying Russia's war in Ukraine threatens a fragile recovery from disruptions caused by the pandemic. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakwaswara reports.
Russia's war in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Moscow have disrupted global commerce, pushed up oil prices, threatened food supplies, and increased uncertainty as the world struggles to recover from the pandemic, causing the International Monetary Fund to downgrade its global economic outlook. IMF Chief Economist Pierre-Olivier Gourinchat.
Even before the war, inflation in many countries had been rising due to supply-demand imbalances and policy support during the pandemic, prompting a tightening of monetary policy.
The IMF slashed its global growth forecast from 4.4% to 3.6%, the World Bank from 4.1% to 3.2%. Increased energy and commodity prices have led to less output and more inflation. The White House is blaming Moscow. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We've said this from the beginning, that the invasion of Ukraine by President Putin and Russia is going to have a continued impact on the global economy, whether it is on the oil markets or other areas.
Add to that a slowing of the Chinese economy due to frequent lockdowns caused by the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. Diana Fortgoth-Roth, adjunct professor of economics at George Washington University via Skype.
First of all, China has imposed a quarantine of 1 week on goods that come into China. And that means that manufacturers that use chips from other places, such as South Korea, are not getting the inputs they need to make the goods in China. Second, There's congestion at the ports because of the lockdown, such as Hong Kong and Shanghai.
A key goal for central bankers attending the spring meetings of the IMF and World Bank in Washington is to curb inflation without sending the world into recession by gradually increasing interest rates, preferably in a coordinated way. Desmond Lachman, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and former deputy director at IMF's Policy Development and Review Department, via Skype.
That would prevent inflation from spilling over from one place to the other, but it's a delicate task because we do have equity markets that are very buoyant. We've got housing markets that are very buoyant. So this is not going to be easy to raise interest rates in a way that will bring down inflation without producing a recession. They probably let the inflation get too far ahead of them for them to engineer a soft landing at this stage.
Amid Western efforts to isolate Russian President Vladimir Putin, coordination may prove challenging. The U.S. is skipping some of the group of 20 G20 finance ministers' meetings this week to protest Moscow's participation in the group over its actions in Ukraine. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Administrators at secondary schools in Kenya are requesting to carry out drug tests on students to curb indiscipline in schools. The proposal came from a conference in Mombasa that brought together head teachers and school administrators. The conference also discussed other issues, including public funding, mental health challenges among teachers, and student unrests. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
The 45th Annual Conference of Secondary School Principals kicked off in Mombasa as teachers contemplate how to bring discipline in schools that have suffered from unrest. Kenya Secondary School Heads Association Chairman Alfred Indimuli says the government should ensure laws are in place to punish students who misbehave.
Ministry of Education must come up with rules and regulations to manage the Children's Act in education institutions. It's not there. That is why you will find the students will walk scot-free whenever they make mistakes in schools because there is no regulations.
The theme of this year's conference is re-examining the future together, a new era of education in Kenya. Indimuli says discipline is deteriorating among students and schools should be allowed to conduct mandatory tests for drug use among students.
If you look at the Children's Act, they have a responsibility towards their parents and a responsibility towards their nation. But there's no responsibility towards educational institutions. So they can break up things, they can ban their schools. The question we are asking ourselves is discipline going down? Principals, therefore, and teachers lacking the might to manage issues discipline.
Education expert Amos Kaburu says it is illegal to subject students to mandatory drug tests.
It's illegal. You cannot subject children to such kind of tests. And so let's admit that the adults making such suggestions are only but trying to enforce a deterrent mechanism. Otherwise, it has got no legal basis and it can be challenged in any reasonable court of law. So I think the adults who are making such suggestions could either be being naive or let's admit that they're just trying to scare off children, for children to know that, yes, there will always be consequences to any behaviors that you get yourself engaged in.
The National Authority for the Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse in Kenya attributes the rise in cases of school unrest and indiscipline among primary and secondary school students to drug abuse, but Kaburu disagrees.
There is a difference between indiscipline and probably some of the things that we're witnessing. Yes, we got just to realize so many people abuse drugs, but they don't walk around projecting their anger on innocent people and people's property. But I think it's a case of correlation that, yes, the very existence of drugs could also indicate also presence of indiscipline cases and sometimes projected in form of destruction of school property. But doesn't mean that drug abuse leads to destruction of property.
Both primary and high school students in Kenya are now on holiday and are set to resume classes next Monday. Stakeholders in education are blaming students' unrest on the failure to comply with safety standards and the collapse of guidance and counseling programs. Reporting for VOA, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
The Ugandan People's Defense Force and troops from the Democratic Republic of Congo have foiled an attack by rebels on a health center in eastern DRC. This comes as the joint armies continue to counter attacks by the Allied Democratic Forces rebels who operate from the DRC forests. Catherine Nambi reports for VOA from Kampala.
Ugandan officials say 7 to 10 fighters with the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, attacked a health center in Nobiri village. Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, and DRC troops were patrolling the area. Major Peter Mugisha is the Ugandan Army spokesperson for the joint operation against ADF rebels called Operation Shuja.
The joint forces, while they were conducting a hunting mission and a combing mission in Kakuka, had contact with the ADF remnants. They tried to attack, but our own force reacted immediately and repulsed the attack. On the enemy side, two were put out of action.
He says the troops also seized weapons and ammunition from the rebels. Nabidi village in eastern DRC was the center of recent confrontations between the joint armies and the ADF, which resulted thousands of Congolese fleeing into Uganda's Bundibugyo district. The joint armies say they will maintain patrols in the area to prevent any attacks on civilians. Major Mugisha says there are intelligence reports that the ADF now is targeting medical facilities to get supplies to treat their injured colleagues. In a joint meeting early this week to assess the operation, which began late last year, the joint armies agreed on the need for additional forces to protect DRC citizens who return to their homes after they have been retaken from the rebels. Mugisha says the joint forces are overstretched by the rebels, who are highly mobile and fleeing in different directions. The ADF is an Islamist militia that originated in Uganda but has been operating in the DRC for more than a decade. It is among the deadliest of more than a dozen militia groups fighting in the eastern DRC. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now end the show with Matana and the song Anabarifo. Listening to Matana and the song Anabarifo. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.